I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf. I've been consulting for nearly 25 years, and the one teacher and business practitioner I believe every lifelong learner and student of business should study is W. Edwards Deming. And I do have my theories why he's not held in higher esteem outside lean circles. His thinking, in my opinion, complete, pragmatic thinker, believed and taught the law of variation, deep believer in human psychology and systems thinking. Several years ago, I would have said to learn Deming, start with Mary Walton's book, The Deming Management Method. And then in 2021, I came across a book by Edward Martin Baker, The Symphony of Profound Knowledge. That became my favorite Deming book. He also has a shorter book that I like to give away called Scoring a Hole in One. Hole being spelled W-H-O-L-E. Last year, after meeting Gene Kim online and doing an interview on the Phoenix Project, I was introduced to John Willis. John's book is Deming's Journey to Profound Knowledge, How Deming Helped Win a War, Altered the Face of Industry, and Holds the Key to Our Future. It's now the best book I've ever read on Deming because through his research, we learn whose shoulders Deming was standing on. And we observe Deming through an arc of history and his contributions to the economic rebirth of a nation in a second, if only they will listen. I am thrilled and honored to have John Willis to talk about his book, Deming's Journey to Profound Knowledge, here on CFO Bookshelf.
He would start a lecture. He would say, why are we here? And before anybody could answer, he'd say, to learn, to have fun, and make a difference.
Part business history, part biography, part journey into deep business sense. Author John Willis captures the full picture of Deming's life and influence. John Willis is the Senior Director of the Global Transformation Office at Red Hat. John, by the way, was one of the earliest cloud evangelists and is considered one of the founders of the DevOps movement. And he's also the author of 7 IBM Red Books. He's also the co-author of DevOps Handbook and Beyond the Phoenix Project with author Gene Kim. I started my conversation with John explaining why this is now my favorite book on Deming. John, again, I loved this book. I'm not exaggerating. Usually when people ask, hey, where do I start on Deming? I'll say, why don't you start out with Mary Walton's book? That's a good starting point. And then I came across, I want to say 2 years ago, 2 books, not one, but 2 by Edward Martin Baker. One of them is called The Symphony of Profound Knowledge. He also has Scoring a Hole in One, not H-O-L-E, but H-W-H-O-L-E. Both are on Deming. They're very good books, but dry here and there at parts. So I thought, oh, that's my favorite. And then I come across your book, thanks to an interview with Gene Kim. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is the best book I've ever read on Deming. I'm not the only one that said that. Is that right? Is that right, John?
I think the biggest compliment I get, I've gotten some great compliments. And it was a labor of love for well over 10 years. Very passionate about this person, Dr. Deming. He gets into you. But I think the biggest compliment I've been getting, because one of the things I was really worried about is all the old-time Deming people, the people who worked with him and knew, and I'm getting incredible reception from them. They're reaching out to me. They're telling me things like, these are people that spent time with, I never met Dr. Deming. And they spend time with them and they'll tell me, man, I never heard that story. That's an amazing story, or I haven't thought of it this way. And there's a little bit of errata there that I'm going to fix. Minor stuff, right? But but you know, and they're quick to point that out. But I thought I was really sort of, you know, like, okay, you know, who is this guy, John Willis, that's writing a book about a guy, you know? And I was, you know, my paranoid self was like, how are they going to react? And it's been incredible to see and have the conversations I'm having with some of the people that work directly with him in manufacturing. And that's been really, to me, that's been great, you know, to be received by. I knew that my sort of tribe of DevOps and the Gene Kim, I knew they were all going to love it, right? But I to have these sort of old school industrial engineers and healthcare people who don't really know, I don't dabble in the IT world, have them say great things about the book has been amazing.
You and I are both biased. We hold Deming up. He's on a pedestal for us. However, do you think he's still vastly underrated?
You know, it's funny. I think that was one of the things I was talking about when I for 10 years, I wanted to write this book, right? Because I tell people, like, you know, right now, warning to everybody, if you go any further, you will be stuck and it's a nonstop learning. You will be obsessed by this guy. Like, run now if it's your last chance. I think that one of the problems with Deming, in fact, while I was producing the book and more people knew I was coming out with it, I'd get sort of three responses. That it would either be a smaller group who were very much like you and I, you know, like, oh my God, I can't wait this book. Anything Deming, please give it to me, you know. And then the sort of the other end of the spectrum, never heard of the guy. And then there was the middle group, which was always, and that was the, you know, the people that I ran into. In sort of the circles of IT and infrastructure and conferences I go to, that the bigger group was the one, boy, I really should spend more time learning about this guy, because their knowledge of him is the quotes, maybe the 14 points, a little deep because somebody saw a presentation, but very little, you know, very small percentage of people really understood profound knowledge. And I think that's where, like there's so much more discovery. And one sort of interesting thing too is, you know, people got to realize his crowning manifesto, like his you know, sort of achievement of a lifetime in paper, was written in the book that was published today, the year he died, which is, you know, New Economics, which tells us about this gathering of 70 years of knowledge. And so most authors get 20, 30, 40 years to basically tell us about this theory that they came up with, right? He didn't, you know, so we were sort of stuck with a lot of, you know, sort of interpretations. And so, yeah, I think that, like, you know, I think the reason you like the book, the reason why I was so fascinated to write the book, is there's gold in this idea of a system of profound knowledge. And that's the area that doesn't get explored, or sort of where, you know, there is sort of this underrating, if you will, of what Deming can offer to us.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into the weeds, sir, in just a minute. Hey, before we do that, John, I've already given away part of the answer, but we had Kate McCune on our podcast. She was like in the first 10 episodes, and I did not know this at the time, she was a ghostwriter for Deming for about 10 years. And I remember she said, not quite like this, she was very diplomatic, but she said, Mark, he wasn't the greatest of writers. He was a little bit choppy in the way he wrote, and that's why he would have ghostwriters working for him. In your opinion, John, what's the best starting point for reading if someone wants to learn Deming?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of entry points. I think that what most people would agree is his two famous books are probably not the best place to start, you know, Out of the Crisis or New Economics.
Right.
Now, they are necessary reading to be a student of Dr. Deming.
Yes.
You know, I think that for me, it was interesting. It wasn't even a book. Like, the first time I tried to understand system of profound knowledge was like 10 years ago. Like, I was introduced to Deming through sort of actually, you know, indirectly through Gene Kim. You know, Gene Kim, his prior bestseller, the Phoenix Project, was a rewrite of Elliot Gorat's The Goal.
Right.
In a modern circumstances. I met Gene when he was about halfway done with that book. I asked for an early copy. He gave me a great gift. He said, please go read Elliot Gorat's The Goal, and after you've read that, then I'll give you a copy of the book I'm working on. Well, I read The Goal, and then I read It's Not Luck. I consumed everything by Elliot Gorat. And through that, through a set of conversations, I realized a lot of this went back to this guy called Dr. Deming, and literally just started uncovering. And so the first thing you sort of run into is the idea of profound knowledge. And I know we're going to get into it later, but I found that it was really hard to figure out what profound knowledge, even for New Economics, where it's explained very well. In fact, after you sort of learn a bunch of stuff about this stuff, you go back and read those books and you have these incredible, like you start seeing things the way he was really trying to tell it. So I do think some of the things, the easiest things I found was the understanding psychology. I found like there were hospital videos about hand washing that gave these great examples of how bias and things could get in the way of a lot of data, right? Like it was, but I think Mary Walden's, if I had to say there was one book that when I got real serious about writing this book, you know, I think Mary Walden's books were very, very helpful for understanding and unpeeling. And then I wound up just like in my bookshelf has got, you know, a whole row of Deming books. But the meta point is, you know, and like, I do think, and not because it's my book, I do think, and you're not the first person who said this to me, but a lot of people, you know, say that, like, I'm glad I read your book first before I read Out of the Crisis. Right. Because then, like I said, then you get, and I've read Out of the Crisis probably five or six times now. And like there, I go back to it sometimes and I reread it and I'm like, wow, this is what he was a physicist. I don't know if you can blame him for being a great writer. You know, some of my best friends are physicists. They're terrible at explaining to humans how things work. But once you understand the certain levers, and then you read his stuff, you know, about operational definitions or just, you know, just like a whole paragraph that I'll wind up going back to and seeing it another time. And realizing, oh, wow, there was a whole nother layer there, a set of layers that I didn't really get.
Even though I'm not going to disagree with you, I would say your book is now the starting point. Again, I used to say Mary Walden, start there. It's still a good book, but it's very, how do I want to use, formulaic. It's very much driven by the 14 management points, whereas your book, it provides context. It provides history. It provides stories. So I'm at the point to where, no, start with John's book. Oh, by the way, watch a Red Beat experiment. There are several videos on YouTube. Watch the famous interview that he did with, was it NBC about?
Oh, yeah.
That's outstanding. But again, start with your book. Hey, let's hit some of the big ideas. And you saw some of my notes up front. I may be insulting you because it's impossible to figure out what the heck do we talk about. But let's start with Deming the man. This is going to be a very broad question, and I'm going to give you something I learned new about Deming. I shouldn't be surprised, but Deming the man, when I first started reading Deming, the only thing I had to go on was, this may sound disrespectful, curmudgeon, the Red Beat experiment, kind of a no-nonsense guy. But he was far more than what you see on YouTube doing that famous Red Beat experiment. Now that you've written about him, what do you think about when you think of
that? Now, I you know, he reminds me of, you know, one of my uncles was this born almost the same year he was born. And I you know, like a loving man, but on a surface level, like did not suffer fools well. And those fools could be his nephew, you know. So You know, I often wonder, like, if I met Dr. Deming, you know, how would that conversation go? But the thing I've been assured, and I kind of knew this, let's go roll it all the way back. He was a humanist. He cared about the human condition.
Yes, I mean, he did.
Like, he bleeds the human condition. Now, was he sort of, you know, I wouldn't say impatient, because if you, you know, if you hear the stories of, like, if you wanted to, everybody I met, when I meet the old school guys, I can't. I grab onto their leg and I won't let them go. You know, I want to hear everything about, like, their encounter with him. And you know, if you wanted to learn and you were willing to do your homework to learn, you know, if you were just going to go there and ask him a bunch of questions and he didn't realize you were going to learn anything, like, he was very sort of, he didn't have any time for you. He didn't time for management, you know, that wouldn't sort of accept. But if you were there and you did, you know, the Doris Quinn's chapters, right? Great example how, you know, if she would show up for, you know, Doris Quinn would go and travel with him. This amazing story of this woman that, like, that I found, that I met and I interviewed, and I got to write about her in the book. And she would tell the story about, like, he'd invite her to go to General Motors, or, like, the last year, couple of years of his life, she traveled with him. And she'd say, if she showed up for that flight and didn't have a set of questions, he'd shut down. He'd be mad at me. He'd, like, almost like I'm putting words in her mouth, but almost like a little child, you know, he'd, like, pout. And he was just, you know, he just wanted to be around people who wanted to learn. And so he was a humanist. He cared about the human condition. You can see that from Hawthorne all the way to Japan, all the way to his Out of the Crisis, which wasn't a get-rich-quick book. It was literally, hey, I'm 80 years old, and I'm worried about this country. You know, I'm writing a book not to teach you how to become a great management consultant. I'm writing a book that maybe we can shake up education, government, healthcare. But, yeah, I think he's very unique. I think he has that old school, you know, they just don't mess around. Their words have meaning. But, you know, the one thing I love that I've heard now, I didn't know this until sort of within the last year as I'm meeting the old Deming crowd. They say that every time he would start a lecture, he would say, "Why are we here?" And before anybody could answer, he'd say, "To learn, to have fun, and make a difference." And, like, that pretty much says who he was right there, right?
18 months after the surrender of Japan at World War II, and I may have my months off, John, Deming makes his first trip over to the country. The economy is still a train wreck, which I didn't know was still that bad that long after the surrender. And every chance he gets, he's giving away food because the people there that he meets are impoverished. And then for the rest of his career, anytime he was in Japan, he never took money from anyone in Japan. That's the part of Deming I loved. And I was not aware of that. Were you?
You know, I knew that he had given, you know, the donation, like, he didn't accept any royalties from his sort of classes and material that he allowed them freely to take. I found these great stories where he'd sneak off the bay. He'd go to the PX and get a bunch of stuff and sneak. Right. You know, the thing was that, like, the humanist in him, you know, so that there's some theories that I come up with during the book, right? Like, you know, I think, you know, at some point, you know, when there's a base of knowledge about Dr. Deming and enough people I've interviewed, I can make some theories of my own. And I think Hawthorne had an interesting effect on him, right? In other words, he saw the best and worst,
right,
of sort of industrialization, right? He saw, because if you read my chapter about Hawthorne, it was an incredible, interesting experiment. It wasn't like the coal mines or the Hershey. It was that when you left the factory, it was this incredible way of life that the corporation was building for each other, allowing people to get loans, allowing, you know, putting money into saving and loans companies, sporting things. I mean, but inside the factory, it was, you know, the jungle, right? Like, it was the, you know, it was all the sort of ingredients. And so I imagine just seeing that, you know, at his early age about, wow, this is an, I think all of us, when we think about, like, our first real big job, right? Like, how the impression of where I worked at Exxon, and I was fortunate. I was able to see an interesting, you know, an interesting way of it was exploration. It was during the boom of oil, but like that shaped me in how I saw the world from industry, from organizational structure. So he sees that at an early age, goes through these processes of working with government agencies, and then winds up in Japan, where it's a just completely different set of motivation, intrinsically motivated people. And I think like that part of him just fell in love with the culture, everything about the culture, the food, the kabuki theater, the way they were so, you know, they were serious about learning. He said that the statistics to the juice students were the best students he had ever had, right? And, you know, so there was this incredible relationship between a guy who wanted to learn, loved people who wanted to learn, didn't really go well with all the nonsense that goes on in organizations, and then seeing sort of a no-nonsense culture and improvement culture, and just, you know, like it becomes, you know, 1 + 1 = 15 in terms of his ability. And I said this to Doris Quinn, you know, spent a lot of time. I said, would you accept this theory that I have that he learned as much from Japan as Japan learned from him? And she said, that's a really interesting question that I've never heard somebody ask, right? And I think the answer is absolutely yes.
I agree, only because I've read the book.
There you go, yeah.
Let's turn the clock way back, and you did when you went back to Hawthorne. And I don't know if it's before then or after then. I think it would have been right around that time period, because I think he bumps into a guy named Schuhert, which, by the way, if that name doesn't make sense or doesn't ring a bell, one of my favorite books that I give away, I don't know how many of these copies I've given away, but one of the books on variation by Donald Wheeler. I am a huge, huge fan of Donald Wheeler. He has a simple book on understanding variation that any high school student could go through this book and pick it up. Well, he's standing on the shoulders of Schuhert. And I think it was from Schuhert that he learned the concept of determinism versus non-determinism. Could you explain those two real quickly?
Yeah. No, you know, so for me, it goes back to another sort of interesting thing that really piqued my interest is, you know, I told you earlier, Gene Kim and I did Beyond the Phoenix Project. Well, the reason I approached Gene on that, because Gene and I had always thought that Elliot Gorat's Beyond the Goal, which is an audio-only book that he did 20 years after he wrote The Goal, and it's just an amazing piece of work, right? It is his experience and explanation of everything he learned since he wrote The Goal, Elliot Gorat. But there's a part in there where he tries to explain the difference between way a physicist thinks and all the other sciences. And it's just hilarious, and but it's also so insightful. And then he goes through this example, and it's a great example, you know, and a couple of examples of how a physicist wins a Nobel Prize, you know, and it's just great Gorat stuff. And you get to hear him laugh at his own jokes, right? But then he says, oh, and by the way, it goes into a serious mode, and he says, oh, by the way, myself and Dr. Deming were both physicists. And I thought, wow, two guys that, like, out of all the management science that I've read, you know, the Druckers, the, you know, and again, nothing wrong with all these guys, but all the sort of quality stuff that I've been reading, why are these guys so different than everybody else? And I really started pulling that thread. And a good friend of mine, Mark Burgess, who is the inventor of a whole genre of infrastructure development called Infrastructure as Code, he was a physicist. And I got to help him with some of his products, and he got to help me understand what does non-determinism really mean? And it, you know, and I think, you know, as I went back, I, you know, another set of theories is, you know, these, you know, Gorat and Deming and Ono, and there's a group of people that were all getting, and Schuhert, of course, were all physicists that were physicists at a time of what we would call the second scientific revolution.
Right.
Newtonian to quantum, right? And that was just turning everything upside down. And it's kind of interesting that Deming's work is sort of turns everything upside down from classic management theory. But yeah, I think, you know, I think part of, before I went into the book, I would have said, like, Deming got it all because he was getting his physics degree, you know, right at the time when, you know, all the stuff, you know, Einstein and Schrodinger and all this Heisenberg, you know, all that stuff. In fact, remind me, I got a great Heisenberg joke, with not joke, Deming story in a minute. But then as I went in and I really wanted to understand, like, the theory of knowledge, right, epistemology, I found, like, a lot of the sort of really great stuff Deming had. Doesn't take anything away from Deming. Came from Shewitt. You know, Shewitt is the one who recommended, you know, Shewitt, obviously, variation, statistical process control. And that had a major impact on Deming, right? The whole I would say it's core to all system profound knowledge, but if we wanted to break it up in four parts, it's the understanding variation, or Donald Wheeler's work, right? But the theory of knowledge, where I was able to go back and figure out, like, Shewitt was a big fan of pragmatism, particularly this book called Mind in the World Order by C.S. Lewis. And that wasn't enough. I went back, and if you read the stories about C.S. Pierce, right, like, those are the things I love writing books like this, because I can see why Michael, and again, I'm not putting myself in the Michael Lewis category of a writer, but I can see why he enjoys writing these stories. Because when you find a guy like C.S. Pierce, who literally changes the world with pragmatism, and then you find out, like, he is this horrible human that's, you know, like, has all these, like, terrible characteristics, but this brilliant, it's just like, you sit there and you get chills going, man, this is going to be great telling this story, you know? So Shewitt is the one who recommended Mind in the World Order to Deming, and Deming sort of said it, and I think Deming was being a little self-deprecated here, where he said it took him six times to read World in Mind Order. But I literally solicited a PhD physics friend of mine to read it for me so he could explain it, and then I could try to read it. So I did a little bit of Tom Sawyer work there, so I'm having somebody paint my fence. Jay Bloom, by the way.
I hope you don't mind me taking a little bit of poetic justice here. I'm calling it the Core Four.
Yeah, yeah.
That's cool. And the Core Four, again, I'm going to go back to why I like your book so much. Unless I've missed this Core Four, I don't really see these four big ideas, these four concepts of Deming's thinking coming out in these other books. So here's the Core Four, as I'm calling it. You just said one word: pragmatism, variation. Which, by the way, going back to Shewhart was he created the control chart really for to understand variation of all of the stuff they were building, phone equipment at the Hawthorne plant.
Right.
And oh my gosh, I didn't know this. 4,000 inspection workers.
Yeah, yeah.
Over 40,000 employees.
Yeah.
And again, that was a little nugget. It's like, oh, I didn't know that. So anyway, variation. And then Deming comes along and says, wait a minute, we can apply these control charts in the office, which again, you tell another story, which is incredible. So again, there's two of them: pragmatism, variation, human psychology, which you said a few minutes ago. And then the last one, last but not least, this is why I think where profound knowledge comes: systems thinking. I think systems thinking, again, this is opinion, this binds everything together. I think this is why Deming is so special. He's a holistic thinker. Yeah. He doesn't think in parts.
That's right. Well, and it's so core, right? Like, you know, I think that like you can clearly, sort of pragmatism, which turns out to be called theory of knowledge, right? Which just goes back to scientific method, right? It's epistemology, right? It's, and I think of it like nobody orders I like this idea of ordering it. And I've never read anybody order it. And then some argue, like, if you order it, you're trying to say you need one versus the other. No. It's a holistic view. In fact, if you think about Peter Senge's fifth discipline, what is the fifth discipline? It's system thinking, right? And, you know, I even tried the fourth discipline, but, like, I got hammered. That one I'm going to stay away from. But I do like the idea of, like, okay, how do we know what we think we know? Right? That's the theory of knowledge. Like we, you know, this idea that, you know, that variation exists everywhere. We don't really know the answer to any question. We have an abstraction, human language, so that if we go into the assumption, this is non-determinism at its core, that we go into the assumption that we have a theory of what we think we know, but like, let's not be arrogant or non-scientific. Let's go ahead and treat it as a theory. And that's theory of knowledge. And so the understanding variation is a tool for us to basically analyze what we think we know, right? Be able to look at the control chart is a great example of, you know, like Deming, you know, so Shewitt created statistical process control and the control chart. Deming coined it as analytical statistics versus enumerated statistics, which apparently drove all the academia statisticians nuts, right? And so that's the tool of like, how do we take from what our hypothesis is to using some form of data? Okay, this is the part it gets incredibly brilliant, which is, okay, stop for a second, take a deep breath, and what are the human conditions that might get in the way of understanding these complex systems or making changes? Because humans have bias. Humans have motivation. They have intrinsic versus extrinsic. And decoupling all that as a necessary ingredient. And then what's the fourth? It's systems understanding systems or appreciation of a system, but systems thinking. And going back to what I wanted to do once I started writing the book, I needed to figure out where did he get all these pieces from? Right. And I got to tell you the Heisenberg story. So I met a guy recently. It was a reunion of a bunch of old Deming folk. Right. And I got invited to it and got to have these glorious stories of different people. And this one guy told me that he got his undergraduate in physics, but then he went into more like supply chain, industrial engineering, went to work for Ford. So it was his first job. And he becomes the guy at, oh no, General Motors, but it doesn't matter. It could have been General Motors, but it's General Motors. And he is the guy that basically is told he has to go pick up Deming at the airport and bring him to the office to meet all the muckety mucks, right? So that's his good first job. So he reads up on Dr. Deming, sees that he was a physicist. So he picks him up. They're in the car driving to the headquarters, the General Motors headquarters in downtown Detroit or whatever. He figures he's going to impress him by asking him a question about Heisenberg, you know, uncertainty principle, right? You know, and he says, Dr. Deming, you know, what do you think about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? And he says, Deming goes, huh, Heisenberg, yeah. Had lunch with him once. Best apple pie I've ever had. It's so Deming, right? He's not going to brag about how he knew him. He went right to like food and like, you know, the best apple pie. Didn't like, oh yeah, well, you know. And, you know, just hilarious, right? So.
We'll be right back. Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host, Matt Heslin, brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Let's go back to Japan, if it's okay. Mm-hmm. For readers who may know a little bit about Deming, I think there's this association, quality, Deming, Japan, cars. So again, I want to go back to Deming's origin story there in Japan. Again, I did not know things were this bad in manufacturing. I did not know that they were producing about 4 cars per employee. And that lasted for a number of years. And then it became 60. What's peculiar, we'll jump ahead, Ford and GM, they did not improve like that. I'm going to say something that's not true. Deming was fully responsible for that turnaround. Help to explain.
The thing, you know, it is easy to become a Deming sycophant, right? Because yes. there's so much there. The thing I needed to do, you know, and it was, you know, I would probably speak, some people who have already read the book or might read the book in the future and say, what do you mean? That guy's definitely a Deming sycophant. And I am. But it was important to me to try not to, and that was another thing about a lot of the other books. They really sort of, the man who invented quality, you know, that, and like you could see why, you know, like I'm going a sidestep here, but why some other people like Duran, and like there's so much backlash by these other camps because like all the, it was, Deming was fine. Like Deming never criticized, you know, like I couldn't find anything where he made any negative criticism against the people who were clearly writing stuff about, like, Deming didn't really do this or he didn't do that. And I think it's because all the people who wrote about him. And I think that was another common characteristic of the writers. You can see their sycophantia in their writing, which, again, for me coming into it, I'm like, this is great. But when I sat down and said, I want to write this book, I said, you know, I want to be a little careful. And so, you know, like one of my favorite sort of quotes in the book, which is, Deming didn't create the miracle in Japan. The Japanese created the miracle in Japan. And that's really important because you had, you know, all those conditions, the way they, the intrinsic motivation, the way they thought about work, the way they thought about family and work, and the way it was a tsunami culture. The conditions you talked about, like one of my favorite books as part of learning here was not really a book written. It had Deming in it. It was The Reckoning. And The Reckoning, like, it told you how terrible it was. It was, for me, you know, I haven't read all the history books about post-World War II, but to read The Reckoning and get the feeling of, like, the roads, the electricity, people were sleeping in subways, right? You know, and you're right, this was, you know, almost 2 years after the war, right? I mean, you know, MacArthur needed people to come over
right.
to get the lights on, to be able to get roads that could be navigated. So this, it was a so all these conditions. And then you had, you know, the other thing I felt really good about writing was, you know, the, you know, we talk about like in the U.S. during World War II, you know, the Manhattan Project, there were like these side projects that were statistics and mathematicians doing, the Abraham Wald story, if anybody's look it up, it's an amazing story, right? Well, of course, the Japanese had mathematicians and statisticians doing similar work, right? And in fact, one of the really most interesting parts that I got from The Reckoning was these statisticians that were doing the same work that Abraham Wald and the statisticians who were trying to, you know, how do you repair fighter planes and metal, you know, distribution and weights and all those things, right? I'll just leave a cliffhanger of where the bullet holes aren't, right, story. But there was these Japanese statisticians that were basically the same, like they were same people. They were smart. They were, and they were trying to solve these same problems. And The Reckoning, that I love this sort of story where when they capture a U.S. plane, these statisticians would say they were sickened by the gap of the quality of the American planes versus ours. Well, those are the guys that, you know, Kichi Kiangi, right, who masterminds this whole thing of getting Juice renamed, doing all this stuff, trying to get Deming in. There's a love affair between Deming and these incredible, you know, Deming is quoted as saying they were the best students he's ever had. So at the macro level, all of these conditions are perfect. A tsunami culture that likes to rebuild, that understands that in their DNA is this continuous improvement. The way they think, the way they collaborate, all that from, and Toyota, like about how Toyota has all these conditions. And so Deming goes in and, you know, sort of gives them the lighter to the lighter fuel, the, you know, the fuel. So we got, I think we have to be really careful on, you know, on saying things like Deming created the miracle or the man who created quality, or because we do an injustice to not only other Americans that went over there, like Turan, Ashurishin, I always pronounce his name wrong, but the first guy that went over, we do an injustice to their impact to what happened. But Deming definitely was, you know, as he said, he told the Japanese, he'll light a prairie fire, and he lit a prairie fire.
You stated that the Japanese, they had the statistics before Deming ever got there. they had the statistics pre-World War II, but they put them aside. So they learning the math, learning the statistics, learning Shewhart, this is not new to them, was it?
No, and in fact, the interesting part was, you know, when you get into that whole discussion about Sorensen, and I always get his name pronounced wrong. I have this, I don't have dyslexia, but I think I have dyslexia with certain names. But he's the guy that came over first, and he got the lights on. He got the fact, but the juice people knew there were more, was more here. And I wrote about this, right? So they kept asking, what about, isn't there something else? They kind of indirectly knew about Shewhart's work because that stuff had come over pre-war.
Right.
They didn't have the material anymore, but they knew there was a lot more to control charts and analytics than Sorensen. And Sorensen was like, you know, in his defense, he was trying to get the lights on. He was like, guys, let's not worry about that compliment. And maybe he was, this is where they love Deming, is he was a little more of the conqueror. Again, this is my literary license. Hey, shut up and just do this. We got to get the lights on. Stop asking about that. And this core group of Kayangi and the Juice, they knew there was more and they wanted to learn more. And the beauty of Kayangi is he basically navigated a way to get Deming over because he knew, I mean, they wanted Shewhart first, but for their benefit, they're so lucky that Shewhart was sick and Deming came. But Kayangi knew it was Deming that he wanted because he had been hearing and saw some of his lectures. You know, Deming was in India, right? So then Deming comes in and he's not like, oh, no, don't, you know, Deming's the last guy to say, you know, oh, that's too complicated for you. You know, like he's the guy like, oh, you want to learn that? Come on, let me tell you more, you know, and now they have this magic. Right. So, yeah, they knew the math. They knew the statistics. They knew there was something missing in the original sort of statistical quality control, the QC programs that were originally brought up before Deming. They were like, yeah, now we know this already. Like, this doesn't help us, you know, and they knew once they got Deming, Deming's like, oh, yeah, let me tell you that, you know, how this stuff really works.
Before we start to wrap up, again, this has been great, John. I want to go back to Hawthorne one last time.
Sure.
When, again, the casual Deming reader who has a little bit of knowledge of Deming, they may think of, again, he's the quality person. He's the guy who had a big impact on Japan. But that's just a small part. Because, again, going back to Hawthorne and the impact, the effect that environment had on him, I keep thinking the human psychology, his view of people. If you dig into some of the 14 points, you know, drive out fear, you know, no quotas. I just think we're missing something because this is not about quality. It's not just about statistics. It's about people, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you don't come to those conclusions easily. They're counterintuitive to sort of, you know, classic, you know, sort of Tayloristic Sloan thinking, right? Well, you don't drive out fear. How does that happen? You have to be a humanist. You have to care about the human. And I don't know that Taylor, you know, like people call Taylor, like, you know, the worst person. Like, I mean, I tell people the reason we have like iPhones and incredible computers on our hand, you know, we probably should give thanks to guys like Taylor and, yes, and Sloan, and right, because the industrialization of America, right, like happened with all that. But clearly, you know, I love the quote. One of my sort of favorite comparison quotes was that when Sloan said something like, you know, Sloan was the original CEO of General Motors, right? And he said that, you know, we don't make cars. We don't make great cars. We make cars that make money, or something like that.
Right.
And Ono said, we don't make great cars. We make great people who make cars, right? So Deming gets that. Now, I don't know that Ono got that from Deming, right? But Deming probably gets that from the culture over there, right? Because he's willing to see it. And how do you, you know, like like, you know, you can always tell somebody, even when we're teaching DevOps or sort of organizational design or any of your work you're doing with, you know, trying to understand how to improve an organization, you know, a leader who understands and listens to their people is just so different to then the do this. It worked. My last company, you know, I don't really want to hear any, you know, I've been brought in to do these five things. We're going to do these five things. The most effective leaders are the ones that come in day one and they want to understand how everybody thinks and they want to do some kind of, you know, quantitative assessment of how things work, right? And Deming was that person, right? So, you know, that enables you to learn from other people and then to be able to go over to Japan and learn from that culture, right? Like just allows you to have all these, the 14 points basically.
The first time I ever heard the Numi story was from a book by Matthew May called An Elegant Solution. Great book. Ron Baker mentioned it to me. Thank you, Ron, if you were listening. We had Steve Spear on just a couple of weeks ago, and Numi is mentioned in Wiring the Winning Organization. Well, guess what? You bring it up. And, you know, I never get tired of talking about Numi. It's like, no, I want to hear it again. And again, just a brief, quick synopsis of Numi. It's one of the greatest business stories ever.
It is an amazing story. And by the way, there's actually a documentary from basically the Japanese NPR from the Japanese side with subtitles, which is, I'll send you the link. That is incredible. But yeah, I mean, the Numi story is amazing, right? Like what happened is that it was the Fremont, California was the first worst General Motors plant. It got shut down. It was so bad that, you know, the workers would put, you know, on Fridays, they put beer cans in the door panels because they were too lazy to go to the garbage can to throw them out while they were drinking. You know, I mean, it was just, there was, you know, theft, there was, you know, alcoholism. It was just, and it eventually got shut down. But it was an amazing plant location and all that. And so when, you know, there was some changes in tariff laws, and this is interesting about how Toyota is like such a special. This is why I love Dr. Spear, right? He nails, he nails what is so special about Toyota in so many ways in his High Velocity Edge and, you know, certainly in his new book, The Wiring the Winning Organization. So the idea was, okay, Nissan and I think Yamaha, there was a couple of Yamaha, not cars, but there were a couple of manufacturers. Oh, Honda and Nissan were opening up plants in America. And because the tariff situation was, you know, you could either ship a car over and pay all the taxes on it, or you could ship the parts and manufacture it, which is essentially the same car. So, but the thing was that Toyota, in their brilliance, realized, well, let's not go all in. Let's experiment. And so this joint venture between GM and Toyota, and the story, so the brilliance was, that's the way the Toyota does things. They experiment. They think like scientists. Dr. Spears, in his you know, sort of his, the HBR article, you know, the story about decoding the right Toyota person DNA. He has a quote, which I sort of changed a little bit, but Toyota was a community of scientists continually experimenting, right? Like that was the DNA there, right? And so they do this. But the real great story was they literally hired back basically all of the workers that were at that plant, that was the worst plant. They basically sent the management team over to Japan. That's what this documentary, the sort of Japan side, is that story of how they took classes, how they learned, all that stuff, right? They come back and it becomes, for a period of time, the number one plant. So the guy here is the same factory, same location, same line, same people, still unionized. But the difference was the way the management was trained. And this is so Deming, right? Deming says the red beat game. Like, what is the final answer to what do you change? I've run the red beat game many times. And so I ask people at the end, like, what could we have done differently? And the real answer is to get management to change something. Maybe we should go get management to see why we're working with the suppliers that are giving us all those red beads in the first place. So the idea is, like, it was sort of classic Deming. Even though there's no real connect dots that say, oh, Numi and Deming. But like What changed? It was like what Deming screams about in Out of the Crisis, what he screams about in Neurocronics is the prevailing system, you know, the prevailing system of management. Like, what is wrong? How do you change things? You have to change the leadership and the minds. And that was a classic great story. Now, it didn't last, and it didn't last for a number of reasons that had really very little to do with the success of NUMMI. One is Japan, that Toyota realized, okay, well, now we know enough. Let's go create our own plant in Kentucky. And the Kentucky plant stories are even more phenomenal, right? So,
well, and plus GM has to go and go bankrupt too. It didn't help either.
Yeah, you got a couple of things like that too.
Does this fella look familiar? I'm holding up a book, Always Think Big, by Jim Mattress Mac McInvale. For anyone living in and around Houston, Texas, they know that name. The thing that bothered me about Deming, not about Deming, but I never could find non-manufacturing stories surrounding Deming. You brought us a few. The Edward Martin Baker book is the first book that I recall reading where, oh, here's a story. So Jim is in his book scoring a hole in one. I believe it's in that book, and he mentions him in The Symphony of Profound Knowledge, again by Edward Martin Baker. The brief story is that this furniture store guy goes to a workshop, a four-day workshop of Deming, and it turns his life around. He may have gone to more than one. He goes back to his extremely, extremely successful furniture store and says, no more commissions. We're done. No more ranking. And believe it or not, at first, salespeople didn't like it.
Yeah, sure.
But then after a few months, sales went even higher. Why? Because everyone's working together. This is why, not really a question, John, this is why business owners, managers today need to know the message of Deming. It works. It's not really a question, but jump in if you want.
Yeah, no, it's systems thinking, right? It goes back to, I mean, the core of, like, if you read New Economics, you almost start thinking like Deming is a communist, right? You know, but the first thing he said to Japan, you know, his famous Mount Hakone, right, where he, it, like 80% of the wealth of the nation in 1950 is in this room waiting to listen to him. And he says, if you follow my methods and ideas, like you will be a number one economy or, you know, and almost in within 5 years and almost to the date, 5 years, they're number two. Right. But that whole message that he gave was systems thinking. It's like, don't compete with each other, like at a macro level. Right. Like right. Telling corporations that classically compete with each other. He did this in the 60s and 70s with transportation. It some people listened to him a little bit, but not like the Japanese did. And that's what he tries to tell you. Don't like the, you know, and it's hard to swallow. I've had a lot of startups and I, you know, when I own a startup, I sort of cherish my top lead salesperson who gets deals with large banks that are almost impossible to have. And you got to pay them, you know, so they're like, I still struggle, but fundamentally I'm a believer in systems thinking. And the whole systems thinking is that, it's a bigger picture. And if we're cooperating, and we're constantly unraveling the parts of the system, we get to see a clearer picture. You had asked earlier, and I know we're going to run out of time about management by means, right? That's a the classic sort of Telleristic Sloan sort of prevailing system of management. The Western management thinking is management by objectives or management by results or OKRs or KPIs. And we're conditioned and we create this we're a battleground where we're sort of constantly fighting everybody and we're not getting the full effect of our system. You know, we got a team that's like sort of hoarding a little bit because they're winning, not sharing. They're the conditions that they're creating to create these great bonuses, all that stuff, right? Sort of gets in the way with the large effect of the corporation. And so, and like that all is core. And again, I, I try not to say the fourth discipline in System of Profound Knowledge because I've gotten hammered by people and I really haven't had a great like way to respond other than but I think that's like all parts have to work together, and that's why people get upset when I say the fourth discipline. But system thinking, like the fifth discipline, is the wrapper. And it is the thing that makes the difference between calling it the system of profound knowledge versus just some cool, profound information.
I've always wanted to ask a student of Deming this question, and I can't find the answer. Sure, I could Google it. I don't want to Google it. I want to read it in a book. I want to read a story about it. I don't think it exists. Did Deming and Drucker ever meet or have conversations ever? Do you know of?
You know, there's a lot of connections. So the answer has to be yes. I don't know the exact example, but Drucker was a student of Acuff, and Deming and Acuff were
exactly right.
So there's I don't think there's any scenario where he didn't collaborate. There are certain things that I want to go to the Library of Congress and just because one of the things that Deming was classic, and he'd just write, letters to people, he would like, and so actually, just as a foreshadow, I'm writing a similar book now on the history of AI, generative AI. So a very storytelling, Michael Lewis style. And not, I don't want to be, again, the Deming sycophant, but it'd be really cool to find, Deming was around a lot of the people who were instrumental in the sort of early definitions of AI, right. McCarthy's, the Minsky's, all these guys. I can't see a scenario where Deming didn't correspond with, Norbert Wiener, the father of cybernetics, right? Like, he was in Aberdeen, and Aberdeen, Herbert Simon, Norbert Wiener, they were all in that think tank during World War II in the chapter I call Classified, right? I would love to dig up a letter or something where Deming did some like question about a neural network or like that would be gold, right? But the point being that I think to find those nuggets, there's no doubt that Deming would have read something or knew Drucker through Acuff. And even if they didn't meet directly, I just got to believe he would have sent some letter, his whole famous second edition Senge letter, right? Where, Senge sent him an early copy of the book. Deming read it and wrote a letter, and Senge put it in, the first revision in the book, right? Like that was the way Deming was, right?
I did not know that at the time.
There's a Deming letter inside the fifth discipline. It's famous, And what does he complain about? The way we're teaching students to do grading and all this stuff about how that, which is an endorsement of Senge's system, one of the fathers of system thinking.
By the way, speaking of Senge, I highly recommend the field guide. It's either the field book or the field guide. Ben Lamore recommended it, and it's so much easier to read if you're having a hard time getting through the fifth discipline. And it's been years since I went through it, but it's either the field book or the field guide. It is excellent.
I like Donella Meadows. That was the goal to me. Donella Meadows, Thinking of Systems. And I've been able to watch some of her videos. I mean, just a woman of so, I don't think I'll have enough time in this earth to write a book about Donella Meadows. But if there was to be a book, she deserves a book. Watch her videos. She's just a beautiful, thinking, cares about the earth human that explains system thinking in such an easy to comprehend manner.
I wish we could keep talking. I even sent you a potential lightning round list, but we're not going to get to it. So let's wrap up this way.
Let's do it again, though. I love this.
Let's do it. And I promise we'll have even new questions to ask. And then we'll finish with the lightning round. But can I ask you, you obviously are a reader. When you're not reading business books, do you have other genres that you love? What are some of the books that rise to the top? When you recommend books, what do you like to recommend?
Well, right now, So right now I've been reading, I've actually in the last 3 months, I've read 10 history of AI books because for my new book, right? So I've really just been consuming that. I like Malcolm Gladwell. You know, I know like the academia folk, but I'm not academia. So like, you know, screw y'all. Like, I love Malcolm Gladwell. I like Bill Bryson. And I obviously like Michael Lewis, right? Like, so those are the, if I'm going to squeeze in time for a book, I'll go ahead and, see if there's one on the shelf that comes out by any of those writers, and or go back to an older one I haven't caught. But those three writers just, instead of watching a movie, those are the books I would read, as opposed to all the other books I still need to catch up with, and read, like a Fifth Discipline, you have to read that. I don't know how many times before you sinks in, but.
Or sometimes have to reread the paragraph or again.
Yeah. Well, the one other thing I did want to tell you about is, so the first version of my, the Deming's Journey to Profound Knowledge had like about 15 other stories in it. And so we, eventually through great mentors, early readers, like, why is this story here? Yeah, you're right. It shouldn't be there, right? So, and even down to the wire where the editors at IT Revolution, who are incredible, Leah Brown and Anna Novak, right? They're incredible editors. And there's a couple of stories I like, they're not going to take this one. I had one called Devil Wears Prada about Deming's wife, right? And but I realized when I gave up that last story, the one I was going to, in my whole cold head steel hand or whatever, I realized, well, there's another book here. So literally, I'm signing a deal now at IT Revolution. It's 18 stories called Profound Stories. And they didn't make sense for the book that I produced because they jagged the arc of profound knowledge. Mm-hmm. But now as a standalone book, I can tell the story like this was a story. It was a great story. It would have been in chapter 4, but like here it is. So I've got the like 18 like credible other stories that don't have to follow an arc of profound knowledge.
John, do we get to interview you with that book?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
you are, sir, a treasure. I love this book. By the way, I read it twice. Do you know I read it twice? Awesome. And great. I want to read it again. Again, I cannot emphasize how important of a work this is. And I owe you big time for writing this book.
Well, thank you for being such a fan. It was like, I can't like Deming, people that want to learn. I want to be around people like you that just love learning, right? Like that's how I like to spend my time.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
I want to leave you with a small homework assignment. Doing this in a small group would be even better. Find Deming's 14 management points. If you do a search online, you'll find them fast. And they are also in John's book, Murray Walton's book, any Deming book. The question is not whether they are still relevant today. Just swap out some phrases to how you would word the points. The question is, do these management points apply in your business right now? Why or why not? Are they complete? What is missing? Good luck on that last question. John Willis, thank you. Again, you are on my radar for future books. We need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.